Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Emma, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop addressing the LGBTQI plus health disparities gap. Now, this is a long-awaited program for many of you on this call today, and today's program is supported by Segan, and I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. And now it's my pleasure to our first speaker, and our first speaker is Mandy Pratt Chapman. Dr. Chapman is Associate Professor, Department of Medicine, School of Medicine and Health Sciences, Associate Professor, Department of Prevention and Community Health, Milken Institute School of Public Health, Associate Director of Community Outreach and Engagement, GW Cancer Center. And Dr. Pratt Chapman will be addressing overview of cancer and the LGBTQI plus community, including HIV and HPV, the LGBTQI plus community's disproportionate cancer burden, addressing the LGBTQI plus health disparities gap, including mistrust of healthcare providers and cancer screening. It is my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Pratt Chapman.
Thank you so much. That's a lot of content to cover in a short period of time, and I know we want to be conversational. I always feel like I need to start with an apology for the number of titles that universities give us. But I will also start with my pronouns, she and her. I am a queer identifying researcher. I've been at GW for 15 years and am very interested in the overall health of LGBTQI communities as well as cancer specific needs. So in terms of an overview, the LGBTQI community, first of all, is very diverse. And I don't know, I know we have about 200 people on the call, so I assume that some people are part of the community, some people may be interested in learning more, but we come from a wide variety of lived experiences, including every race, ethnicity, nationality, religion, zip code. And we're not at greater risk for cancer because we're queer. We're really at greater risk because of the historical stigma that we've experienced along with people of color and other communities in this country that have not had the systems designed to benefit them in a privileged way. So because of that historical stigma, and really I think I would be remiss if I didn't mention that the Human Rights Campaign just issued a state of emergency for LGBTQ health very recently, about 10 days ago, I think, because of the number of bills that have been introduced in 41 states across the country that are limiting transgender sports participation, gender-affirming care, bathroom access. Some of them are forcing outing. And some of them are censoring school curricula and discussion. So there's been 525 bills introduced this year in 41 states, and 76 have been signed into law. And that kind of stress of not knowing if you're safe in a particular environment has significant implications for our health. That it kind of creates a laboratory where cancer can thrive. It doesn't cause cancer, but when we're under a lot of stress over a long period of time, we kind of, our immune system doesn't work optimally in terms of getting rid of these little alterations that happen and circulate all the time throughout our bodies. So that's kind of a way to understand the disproportionate risk. Another thing is really the very clear and targeted marketing from tobacco and alcohol companies, which others on this call may also talk about at greater length. But, you know, tobacco and alcohol companies have really capitalized on queer exclusion to promote belonging through messaging for tobacco products, for alcohol products. There's also a lot of sponsorship of Pride events by tobacco and alcohol, especially alcohol companies. And historically, we didn't have a lot of places where we felt like we could socialize safely. And so, you know, the history of kind of bar culture also has led, in combination with that targeted marketing from tobacco and alcohol companies and ongoing kind of inflammation as a result of stress, to those kind of heightened cancer risk profiles for our population. In terms of cancer at risk, HIV and HPV, HIV, I think most people know, was strongly prevalent in the queer community in the 80s. There is an association with specific cancers, most notably Kaposi sarcoma, which I'm actually never sure if I pronounced that correctly, but also non-Hodgkin lymphoma, cervical cancer, skin, anus, lung, liver, and Hodgkin lymphoma. So there are associations with HIV and those cancers. There's also HPV is a tricky risk factor because there's so many people that are exposed to HPV. I mean, the vast majority of us are exposed to HPV. And there's kind of a misunderstanding that there's a lower risk among women who have sex with women, or if you're not having heterosexual intercourse, that you have a lower risk. But that's actually not at all true. So among both providers and patients, there may be a misunderstanding of the level of risk for cervical cancer, which HPV causes. There's a little bit of a greater understanding, I think, at least in the queer community, I'm not sure among general providers, in terms of higher anal cancer risk among men who have sex with men, also an HPV-associated cancer. And then other cancers associated with HPV are vulva, vagina, penis, and oropharynx. So there's really, I really see HPV vaccination, of course, it's a general population issue, but it's very much a queer issue. And getting our young people vaccinated will really save lives down the road. So that's one call to action. In terms of cancer screening, I'll just mention a few things. This may be very much a review for some people on the call and may be new for others. But in the LGBT kind of cancer space, we're trying to encourage movement toward anatomy-driven screening. So if someone has a cervix, they should be screened for cervical cancer. If someone has a prostate, they should be monitored for prostate cancer. It gets a little bit tricky because we haven't historically, as researchers, we haven't been inclusive in clinical trials. So our data is a little limited in terms of being able to say, this is what we know to be true among people who are assigned male at birth and are female, or people who are assigned female at birth but are male, and what they need for cancer screening and how those play out differently. But a few observations. We do know that there's some hesitancy for cervical cancer screening among transgender men as a result of, you know, major gender dysphoria, unwelcoming kind of clinical settings that are very women-centric. Procedures may also be more painful because of changes with testosterone use, and the histology of screening will look different. So having a pathologist that is familiar with the histological changes that testosterone might bring is important for transgender men and transmasculine individuals on testosterone. Another thing to note is that for transgender women, the prostate is usually intact to preserve urinary continence. So there's a lower threshold for the PSA level that a provider would want to monitor. And if it was greater than 1 as opposed to 4, that would be an indication for wanting to investigate further for prostate cancer. Although, because the PSA level is generally lower, usually, and it's anecdotally, again, we don't have clinical trials for this, but anecdotally, that should reduce risk, but it doesn't make it disappear. And then in terms of breast cancer screening, that's probably the most complicated because we really need to just look at the risk factors in terms of amount of breast tissue, exposure to estrogen, and age. The most up-to-date screening that I'm aware of came about a year or so ago from the American College of Radiology that has some nice case studies of different pathways. And actually, no, I'm sorry. It was earlier than that. It was this year. That have different pathways of queer people with different levels of kind of breast tissue, exogenous hormone exposure, and age. So that's definitely a resource that I would suggest. And then I will just, into kind of a hopeful way, I will just kind of end with, I think that while it is very concerning at the state level, the legislation that has been introduced, I think at the national level, we've seen a lot of really strong progress in thought leadership. So the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force that creates screening recommendations and really health promotion recommendations have moved toward a process of degendering guidelines. It's in process, so not all guidelines are degendered, but they have issued a position statement that they're going to be considering sex and gender in a more careful way going forward for guidelines. The American Society of Clinical Oncology also has a position statement and has issued inclusion criteria to try to expand inclusion in clinical trials. And the National Comprehensive Cancer Network has degendered many of their guidelines. So I think in the interest of time and all of my other wonderful colleagues who have remarks, I will stop there. But I have given to Dr. Messner a number of resources to pass along if that's possible related to what I discussed. And I'm happy to take questions later.
Thank you so much, Dr. Pat Chapman. That was an outstanding presentation. You really set the stage for today's program. And also we did, so for those of you who are live streaming, you can actually download the resources that Dr. Pat Chapman provided. And we will also be sending it to all of you after the program in SurveyMonkey. So you'll be getting it, some of you will get it twice, some of you will see it, all of you will get it once through SurveyMonkey, that's for sure. And for those of you who wish to download this, there are resources that we have that you can download on the website. You can just go on today's portal. You can just go ahead and do that and see them, and then we'll send you out another version as well, the same version in SurveyMonkey. Thank you so much, Dr. Pat Chapman, because there are so many resources. It's wonderful. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Gary Stein. And Dr. Stein is Professor, Director, Gerontology and Palliative Care, Director, Continuing Education, Wurzweiler School of Social Work, Yeshiva University. And Dr. Stein will be addressing barriers to healthcare access, LGBTQI+ discrimination, and healthcare palliative care and supportive care. It's really my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Stein, who happens to be both a lawyer and a social worker. Dr. Stein.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm so pleased to be addressing all of you today. During my presentation, you may be hearing some thunder behind me. We're in the middle of a big storm, so we'll just bear with that. Let me start with some barriers to healthcare access, the social landscape for creating barriers to care. The LGBT community has a long history of discrimination and stigma, and that includes receiving health care of all different types, including care for serious illness, hospice and palliative care, and long-term care, as well as in social services. The organization GLAAD does annual polls looking at social acceptance of the LGBTQI community. The most recent poll supports what's been going on for the last 5 years or so, which is after years of increasing acceptance of the community, we're seeing annual declines of acceptance with also increased reports of discrimination and hate crimes. There's currently, as Dr. Chapman had reported, an unprecedented level of anti-LGBTQI legislation. The ACLU, like the Human Rights Campaign Fund, has been tracking these bills. They found, as of June 9th, 491 bills, and 72 bills passed in Republican-led states. 22 and a growing number have created legal barriers to health care, including creating legal exceptions to state non-discrimination laws, and as well as delaying access or preventing access to gender-affirming care for minors, and also it's becoming increasingly clear that they're looking to do so in many states for adults. This has led to the crisis for the LGBTQI community, creating two separate realities based on whether one lives in a red or a blue state. And examples of how this social environment is creating barriers. People are hesitant to disclose sexual orientation and gender identity, fearing how they will be received. And this is especially so for older adults who have experienced stigma, victimization, discrimination, and criminalization. Discrimination has been documented to concerns about discrimination has been documented to concerns that you will delay or avoid receiving health care. Transgender patients have high levels of mistrust of healthcare providers, and LGBTQI families may be considering moving from oppressive states to obtain necessary care. A New York Times op-ed piece suggested this week the creation of LGBTQ people as a new class of political refugees. I and my colleagues have been conducting research on discrimination of people with serious illness, against people with serious illness, in a project called Project Respect, where we've had up about 300 LGBTQI plus patients, spouses, partners, and widows participating in our survey. Our survey has reported large levels of poor and discriminatory care received by both patients and partners. And these types of discrimination and bad care include insensitivity to the patient, healthcare staff not being aware of LGBTQ plus health needs, patients being made to feel judged for their sexual orientation or gender identity, rudeness to the patient or partner, not using correct pronouns, disregarding patients' treatment decisions, imposing religious beliefs, denying or refusing care, violating privacy, not using birth names, and or using birth names, not chosen names, and making fun and ridiculing patients. Partners report similar discrimination, that they've been denied access to their spouse or partner in the intensive care unit or the emergency room. They say they've been treated badly. Their decisions about their partner's care were not followed. Their visiting hours were limited, or they were denied private time with their partner. While this is a dismal state of affairs, we also receive reports from many of our community of very positive and very good quality care. And respect for their sexual orientation and gender identity. There are action steps that patients and families can take, and let me first highlight some community resources. Patients should obtain support from LGBTQI and LGBTQI-friendly patients and aging organizations for both education and support. The National LGBT Cancer Support Network, the Cancer Support Project, and Cancer Care are very good examples. When people face discriminatory care, there are legal services available. This is especially so in the 22 states and District of Columbia that have civil rights protections for the LGBTQ community. Patients and partners can be assisted with filing complaints with civil rights agencies when it is realistic to do so. And LGBTQ organizations also have legal support, or they can provide referral to such services. Peer support groups are especially important for the LGBTQ community to help think through, should I file a complaint for discrimination issues? Do I have the strength to do it? How will that impact my care? Many of these organizations have telehealth groups which create ease for participation. And of course, individual counseling allows for the discussion of all of these issues. For the organizations that are in our audience, supporting organizations should be looking to develop institutional guidelines that create safe environments for LGBTQI patients and families. And they need to develop strategies to identify, report, and respond to discriminatory care. staff training has long been recognized as an important way to increase competence for working with LGBTQI persons to promote sensitivity, compassion, comfort, and respect, to address their medical, psychosocial, legal, and spiritual concerns, and also to get some practice and knowledge about how to ask about sexual orientation and gender identity as important relationships. Other action steps for patients and families are looking to palliative and supportive care, and these kinds of options should be discussed with the healthcare team upon diagnosis with severe illness to address pain and distressing symptoms, as well as emotional and psychosocial concerns, spiritual and religious concerns. When illness is advanced and time is short, it is wise to discuss hospice approaches to care near the end of life. And finally, another action step for patients and families is an advanced care planning to help prevent discrimination, and also to assure that desired care is received. Advanced care planning would include ongoing discussions with the family and the healthcare team about one's wishes for their health care. Legal documents are helpful to assure wishes and to prevent discriminatory care, and this is especially important when one's preferred decision maker is an unmarried partner or a friend. Such documents protect one's rights and allow people to maintain control over one's care. They allow us to assure your choice of who makes decisions for us when we cannot because of incapacity, and help assure that our preferences for care are respected. One of the participants who completed our survey made a statement that I just would like to provide. Thank you for this project. With the unbelievable events taking place in Texas and many other jurisdictions seeking restrictions on LGBTQ children and adults, we need to keep our community strong and protected. Bigotry will not win the day. Thank you very much. I look forward to, if I'm available for any questions after the discussions, and if anyone wishes to reach out to me directly, they could do so at glstein@yu.edu. Thank you, Carolyn, and everybody.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Stein. That was really outstanding. Just a wonderful presentation, very informative, lots of wonderful resources. And we'll also provide your email address when we send the SurveyMonkey evaluation out as well, so people will have it as well, in case they didn't write it down exactly as you gave it off. And our next speaker is Dr. Scout. And Dr. Scout is Executive Director, National LGBTQ Cancer Network, VP of Social Justice, the Torvis Group. And Dr. Scout will be addressing transgender, gender nonconforming people's cancer concerns, challenges for LGBTQI plus caregivers, and how cancer providers are becoming more welcoming. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Scout.
Thanks so much, Carolyn. I really appreciate it. And it's a pleasure to be here. I think my bio should really just say that I follow Mandy around and present after her practically everywhere she goes. And so with that, let me dive in a little bit. I am a trans person. I am a gender nonconforming person. I'm a non-binary person. And obviously, as you note, I run the National LGBT Cancer Network. And, you know, people brought up the legislation that is out there. We understand that a vast majority of this is really aimed at the trans communities. And we're actually doing a story collection project right now about how that affects our level of medical mistrust. And one of the things that even though it is aimed usually at trans youth or young adults, I do want to emphasize the fact that we understand that this has a splash effect across the larger swath of the communities, and the concerns that we all have are absolutely going up these days, and the level of medical mistrust we all have is absolutely going up right now. And one of the things is the biggest challenge is that the medical community is not actually necessarily responding in kind around trying to assure us safety. So we'll talk about that a little bit more as I get into some of these issues. But if you think about like the cancer continuum, right, it first works with prevention, right? That one of the biggest things we can do there is as a teenager, we can get our HPV vaccine. So that's one of the reasons why it's really concerning that a lot of this legislation is aimed at the young adults and the teenagers, because that means that our medical mistrust is going up the exact time and we need to take one of our boldest, strongest cancer prevention steps. But what is really the case with a lot of my communities is that we are very fearful when we go to any kind of provider to understand, and this is well earned, to figure out whether or not they're going to treat us with dignity and respect. So as we go through kind of the cancer continuum and think about just even getting our cancer screenings later in life, dealing with the discrimination that the world is you know, dealing out to us, we have higher rates of coping skills, things like drinking, smoking, things like that, smoking obviously being highly correlated with cancer. But then if you think about those screening effects, like I'll just give the example that, to be honest, even as someone who's very well-resourced, highly educated, and highly motivated on this point, the truth is I'm often pretty behind on my cancer screenings. And it's because if you think about it, you know, my provider says, hey, please go over and get this colonoscopy. Well, I might trust my provider because I've built up a relationship with her, but I don't know the 40 people that work over in that kind of colonoscopy mill shop. And it's always hard to decide, am I going to be disrespected today? Am I going to put myself at risk for being disrespected today? And it's really easy to always say, how about if I just put that off till tomorrow instead? And one of the things that people may not understand is that myself and a lot of other trans and gender nonconforming people I know, we always call our providers first and disclose that we're trans because we don't want them to be surprised. And we also want to kind of gauge their reaction to figure out whether or not that place is going to be welcoming, because we usually can't find things online. We can't figure out whether we're in the non-discrimination statement for that organization. We actually looked at NCI-designated cancer centers last Pride Month, and a large percentage of them didn't have anything at all about LGBTQI people for non-discrimination or for a patient bill of rights, any special landing page, anything like that. So unfortunately, the medical community is too often silent on establishing safety at the same time that this legislative wave is really kind of drowning many people. So whenever we're referred out from a trusted medical relationship, it means our chance of following through and our level of concern about that absolutely goes up, which means too many of us, first of all, many of us don't even have the trusted, you know, healthcare provider home in the first place. But then if we do, going through the screenings is yet another hurdle. And to be honest, my provider will end up slow walking my hormones if I get too far behind. I kind of hate her for it, but I realize it's an effective way to get me past my barriers, right? Some of the things that other people have done is that providers ask the lead provider, calls other providers, and checks them out in advance. So I don't have to be the one calling the colonoscopy mill to figure out whether it's welcoming or not. So there's a lot of different strategies. It's not that complicated for an organization to put the safety first, right? I was at one of the federally qualified health centers near my house, and I realized in the waiting room there were four different ways they showed me that LGBTQ people were safe and welcome there. They had something up, even though it wasn't Pride Month, about their Pride activities. They had a non-discrimination statement that included it. They had a rainbow flag, and they collected sexual orientation and gender identity data on their intake. Four ways that an organization was assuring me I was safe there. They actually even followed it up with a fifth. Called me afterwards and invited me to special trans and gender nonconforming activities they had. So that just threw it over the top. I wasn't just safe, I was valued, and that was really exciting and not that complicated for them to do. So you can understand the kind of how the trend goes related to these problems. But then if we were in a situation where we have to deal with cancer care, we suddenly become frequent flyers of the healthcare system. And we see that in many cases, as has been said before, we are treated with respect and dignity. But the problem when you become a frequent flyer is it really all it takes is one to suddenly really change your experience of this situation. One of my friends, a trans woman who's undergone cancer treatment several different times, was talking about the amazing care that she got in one of the best cancer centers in this country. But she, on the other hand, when she had a home health aide and she was in the shower, the home health aide was obviously bigoted, was not used to dealing with trans people, and as she's literally weekly crying out, please help me getting me out of the shower, the home health aide is deliberately ignoring her. So again, it's this whole cascade of all the people you see, and our experiences with every one of them can vary from the general population. The sad thing about this is it means that we have higher levels of risks, we have higher levels of lower levels of screening, we have greater levels of dissatisfaction with care, but the flip side of that coin that I really want to emphasize is that it doesn't take much for the health provider community to assure us that safety. So that is really an easy opportunity for a win. Let me move on a little bit to the challenges for the caregivers. The situation really here is related to two major things. One of them I already talked about is this idea that we're not exactly sure where we are safe, right? We don't know if we're safe showing up with our partners as our designated family in treatment. We don't know if all the different specialists are going to be treating us with dignity. And it often falls on the caregivers to do that research and figure that out. So it's yet another burden on the caregivers. And that's on top of the fact that we often come in with a lower level of social support than many of the other people being treated for cancer do. So we may have fewer people in our life. We have, I know some people being treated for cancer right now who have nobody to be their caregiver because of that lower level of social support. So if you have someone like this in your life and you have the opportunity to be a caregiver, just remember, don't presume that we have someone else willing to step in and do that. Step up and see if you can be that champion for us when we really need it. The last thing I really just want to say, and this is some really amazing news, is that we know out of the 66 or so NCI-designated cancer centers in the United States alone, which are some of the best in class, best in world, that there's at least a dozen of them who are actively working on campaigns to be more welcoming for the LGBTQIA population. And that includes showing signs of safety, that includes training their providers, that includes working on that SOGI data, sexual orientation, gender identity data collection, and making sure that there are systems in place from tip to tail so that when we show up, we are treated with dignity from tip to tail throughout the whole experience too. And that's a new trend that has literally just been started. There were a few outliers before, but now that there's a wave of these organizations doing it, we're hoping the rest of them catch up because no one wants to be behind in this group of amazing, excellent cancer centers. And so that, I think, is really promising news for what's to come. The only last thing I'll say is that when we talk about the transgender and gender nonconforming population, we're growing so fast that according to the best available evidence, that it is about 1 out of 10 of all of the youth in the United States, at least. So you might have thought that this was a small, micro population at some point. We are changing quickly, which really shows, again, we all need to get used to they, them as pronouns, things like that. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much, Scott. That was an outstanding, Dr. Scott, that was an outstanding presentation, just wonderful and a lot of information for our participants. I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. And you really highlighted some really key issues for everyone. Thank you. And our next speaker is Mr. Richard Dickens. And Mr. Dickens is an oncology social worker. He is clinical oncology social worker, former director of advocacy, cancer care, researcher, and author in psychosocial oncology, meditation, LGBTQI+. And Mr. Dickens will be addressing the challenges to LGBTQI plus persons living with cancer, practical, financial, emotional, and social concerns, and cancer resources for the LGBT plus community. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Mr. Dickens.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's my pleasure to be on this talk as well. And I want to start out with what Dr. Scout just said is new trends, because even in the midst of the newer struggles, there are new trends that are very positive for our community. And I want to also give a warm Pride Month greeting to my community. Even during the challenge of cancer, I hope most of you are able to participate in Pride activities in your community or create your own Pride ritual to celebrate who you are. I am also a two-time cancer survivor from the 1990s when the rights of LGBTQI patients were still evolving. Quickly, I just want to say the history of LGBTQ healthcare is still very young, but has come a long way. While the gay cultural revolution started with Stonewall in 1969, it wasn't until the AIDS epidemic in 1981 that the healthcare system was forced to address the needs of this community, thanks to the power of advocacy. Advocacy for you and your loved ones is also a way to make meaning of your experience. It's only recently that studies are focusing on the unique health needs of this population. This inequity is most acute in the absence or limited participation of women in pharmaceutical trials. Now, that's good news that there's change there. But the bad news is what the other speakers have already mentioned, that many conservative states are cutting back on services, infringing on this group's rights, and by that action, encouraging discrimination once again. With such a disparate group where you are getting your health care in the U.S., where you are getting your healthcare in the U.S. can impact the quality of that experience. I use the word can loosely because, for the most part, what is happening in the politics of healthcare does not trickle down to the intimate relationship you have with your oncology team. Overwhelmingly, people who go into healthcare have an altruistic calling to help. Still, being a cancer patient in a very busy and imperfect healthcare system often heightens past feelings of being vulnerable. If you feel discrimination is impacting your healthcare treatment, all patients are protected by a National Bill of Rights signed during the Obama administration. But again, as previous speakers have said, those could vary to some degree, or new changes to those in different states could make it more difficult to get all the rights you're entitled to. The most succinct statement I read about managing our emotional and social concerns is from a Kaiser Family Foundation report in July 2022. And it states, LGBT plus people were more likely to report a range of negative provider experiences, including being blamed for health problems or having their concerns dismissed. At the same time, LGBT plus people were more likely to discuss certain health and social issues with their providers than non-LGBT plus people. We are experts in the many types of discrimination which has made us experts in addressing it. Unique to oncology is that in all comprehensive cancer centers, or in most of them in my research, including most regional hospital settings, oncology is provided by a team, doctor, nurse, practitioner, social worker, physical therapist, and more. Among oncologists, doctors are often brilliant in chemistry, but not always good at empathic communication. Just this Wednesday, from an NBC affiliate news outlet in Montana, the headline read, "Doctors have begun using ChatGPT to help them talk to patients more empathically." The point is, doctors are not the only place to get answers. In their defense, oncologists are often too busy to have the time you might need as well. To that end, build a relationship with someone in your team who is more accessible and empathic, often the nurse or social worker. Throughout your in- and outpatient care, social workers are also experts in local resources. In my research, almost all National Comprehensive Cancer Centers have services specifically geared to LGBTQ patients and caregivers. This is the result of advocacy efforts many large hospitals outside this network do too. But don't limit your network to LGBTQI groups. When our community is not available, expand your options by getting into more diverse groups. Your peers are experts on emotional, social, financial, and practical resources. Answers to many practical issues happen on the local level. Joining cancer-specific groups, local or national, might provide you with resources for additional funding specific to your cancer, housing, and transportation resources. Being in a general lung, colon, breast, leukemia, lymphoma, or other cancer-specific group can also better help you understand the emotional and social issues most common to your type of cancer and treatments. Other groups that might be age or gender specific, while not LGBTQI, can still provide a safe place. Many of these groups exist for loved ones as well. With the internet, even people who are in rural areas or isolated because of transportation can still connect to others. As been mentioned, you will receive a list of organizations from me as well that provide an array of cancer services. For those of you who are information seekers, you'll find a wide range of resources, from advocacy, a way to find meaning, to research partnering with your doctor on new treatments, financial help with guidelines, patient navigating education, and supportive services for patients and caregivers. For those who get overwhelmed by too much information, you don't need to know everything at once. Pace yourself. Financial assistance is often limited and runs out until it is refunded. It is frustrating, but not your fault. Also, constant bills take their toll. At some point, speak to someone in the billing department where you are treated. Oftentimes, they can work with you, but you need to let them know. I put an asterisk before three national organizations on the list you will receive, all of which have LGBT-specific programs, but also specific to different groups or in terms of their services. It's been mentioned several times, cancer care, and because of the breadth of their services, which includes direct contact with a master's degree oncology social worker, I highly recommend giving them a call. For any LGBTQI young adults, there is an organization called Stupid Cancer that's been around since 2007, and it has a lot of resources specific to young adults, financial and otherwise, and connects you to the unique issues of young adults with cancer. And now, since cancer really is overwhelmingly 6% of cancers are still diagnosed in people over 60, there's SAGE. It's advocacy and services for LGBT elders. Cancer is most prevalent, as I said, among the older population, and SAGE is at the forefront of addressing these challenges. Cancer is not an easy journey for anyone, but with a team, medical, family, friends, cancer organizations, for some a house of worship, you will get through it. There are so many advances in cancer and a life after treatment. I wish you all the best.
Thank you so much. And that was an outstanding presentation, Mr. Dickens, just wonderful. And I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A. And also the resources that you provided, they are also on our website for those of you who are live streaming, and will also be sent to all of you via SurveyMonkey. And our next speaker is Dr. Stuart Fleischman. Dr. Fleischman is former founding director, Cancer Support Services, Continuing Cancer Centers of New York, now part of the Mount Sinai Health System, author, researcher in oncology. And Dr. Fleischman will be addressing gay men's and lesbian women's cancer issues, military service, affordable housing and Social Security, and the LGBTQ community, and guidelines to communicate with the healthcare team, with telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, and discussion of open notes.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and thank you, everybody, for tuning in on the call today. I have a lot of information to go over, so it may not be in the detail that you wanted, but at least we'll be able to mention some of the things that are important to the community. As far as housing goes, there is a federal fair housing law that covers non-discrimination in housing across the United States. What we have heard about are some more subtle kinds of discrimination for multiple groups, not just the LGBTQI plus community, including people being told that a unit that they're trying to rent, let's say, or buy is off the market or not available when someone else comes along and is actually shown the listing. So things are much more subtle. In Social Security and disability, I have not heard of issues regarding disability per se that are any different for individual communities, but there have been a number of reported cases in the newspapers about LGBT couples collecting spousal benefits for retirement funds or death benefits after a partner, a husband, or a wife dies. Military has come a long way, and where any same-sex relationship trans people were really banned from military service, things have come a long way since 1982, when the criminal and immediate discharge effects in the military were lifted. 1993, many of us lived through the don't ask, don't tell time, in which you could be discharged or actually court-martialed for revealing, but you didn't have to reveal. And things have really come a long way as far as now. things are a whole lot better. There is open acceptance. There is no more limitation in what you can say. Things have really come a long way. The isolation, though, that people feel is still an issue in the military. People feel that even though the law is behind them, that there's a lot of informal discrimination from their peers, and that may just take time until everybody really catches up to where the law has brought us. As far as the cancer-related issues go, I really wanted to highlight a few things, and the speakers before me have really discussed the fact that we are much more prone to getting cancers because of some of the kinds of things that we do, not necessarily who we are, but the kinds of things we do. There has been an increase in use of alcohol, tobacco, and drugs within the LGBTQI community, and that may predispose us to cancers. For women, as far as breast cancer risk, no one really understands the exact mechanism, but there seems to be a pattern where having a pregnancy earlier in life is protective, and not having any pregnancies and having many menstrual periods with rapid changes in estrogen and progesterone levels every month would be a predisposing factor for breast cancer. In cervical cancer and especially head and neck cancers, which don't get too much press, having human papillomavirus in our mouths, in our throats, especially that can be spread through sexual activity, is a critical issue as far as predisposing us to a number of cancers, both cervical cancer and cancer throughout the mouth, the head, down the mouth and through to the throat and even down to the esophagus. It's really important that we be screened properly, as well as for men having sex with men, anal cancers. The type of swabs that are done during a pap smear can and should be done for men and women who are more likely to be passing HPV from one to the other. And that just speaks to all the information you've heard before about having your healthcare done in a place where you feel comfortable in discussing these issues so that your care can be matched with the kinds of things that we are predisposed to because of our behavior, again, not because of identity. As far as particularly male cancers go, anal cancer is an issue. Prostate cancer could be an issue, especially with repeated infections. That it's important to be able to have a place where this can your sexual practices can be discussed as a reflection of the need for greater vigilance for your cancer risk. And HPV, especially in young men, who are either having heterosexual oral vaginal sex or having oral anal sex or oral penile sex, it's important to make sure that people who qualify will get Gardasil, which is the HPV vaccine, to make sure that we're not spreading HPV throughout our sexual partners. So there has been a lot of good things that have happened as far as legislation. There are still pockets of discrimination, certainly. There are still areas and practices throughout the medical care, all throughout the country, maybe some more prevalent than others, and especially in light of recent state legislation that should make us all worried. But it seems like when we take a few steps forward, we take a few steps backward, and none of us are happy about that, but it's really important to see that the trajectory of things is certainly moving ahead. With that, I will turn the program back over to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Fleischman. That was an excellent presentation and lots of important information shared. I'm sure there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And I'm just going to say a few words about the services of cancer care that you'll be able to access as well. And we'll also, you'll all be getting a listing of so many other resources that you can access as well, specific to the LGBTQI plus community. So Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization, really providing psychosocial support to people coping with cancer or cancer-related issues, to both people with cancer and their caregivers. Many people in the United States contact Cancer Care by calling our Hope Line at 1-800-813-4673. And actually, when you call that number, it's picked up by an oncology social worker. And usually people ask a specific question of the oncology social worker, and then they will and they'll get some resolution or some help with their question. And then the social worker will go over all the services that we offer. So what are those services? So our services include a variety of help, and let me just explain what those are. We do offer support to people who call us on a chance to discuss concerns and questions that they may have. We also provide online support groups, and online support groups for every population and for LGBT community as well, and support groups for our caregivers, young adults, older adults, also specific types of cancer. So, and those are all listed on our website, www.cancercare.org. We also offer practical, financial, and co-payment assistance. That's incredibly helpful to people. Of course, the finances, the cost of care is a very unique issue in the cancer sphere, and indeed, people often need help with, let's say, transportation for treatment, or they need help with the cost of their cancer treatments, which actually a co-pay foundation can help a great deal with, significant grants for that. And really just practical assistance as well. We also offer, we also have a PAW program, to assist people who have a cat or a dog, and their illness prevents them from either walking their dog or changing their litter box for cats, and they need help, they need someone to help and with that cost, and they also often need help with the cost of food for their pets or care for their pets, medical care as well. And so we do offer assistance with that. It's a very special program. We probably are the only nonprofit in the country that offers that program, so it's something just to be aware of. We also offer workshops like these on many different types of cancers, topics, and we do offer publications as well. And to get a full listing of everything we do, which would take quite a bit of time to go over, I would suggest you just visit our website, www.cancercare.org. And now we have time for questions. I'm going to ask Emma to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions. I'm going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Emma?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
And this is a question for Dr. Pratt Chapman. Is it possible for low-risk HPV to mutate into high-risk HPV, potentially leading to cancer? If so, what are steps I can take to prevent this?
Oh, that's a good question. I am very much a generalist, so I'm going to tell you what I think, but my understanding is that low-risk HPV is an identifier for strains of HPV, and high-risk HPV is a particular strain of HPV, so I don't think one can convert into the other because there's a number of different types of HPV. But that said, I would ask your doctor that because I am a researcher and not a clinician.
Excellent, thank you. And the next question for Dr. Fleischman: I have the BRCA1 mutation, but I am a transgender man who has had top surgery. That said, am I still at risk for developing breast cancer?
Yeah, good question. Yes, because there's still some breast tissue in the chest area. having screenings done in a good logical way by someone who understands the trans community is vital, and it may take the form of a dedicated MRI instead of a regular mammogram. So read up and then ask people who are specifically aware of the kinds of screenings that need to be done.
Excellent. Thank you. And this question would be for Dr. Scott. My mom is my only living relative, but she doesn't support my lifestyle as a bisexual man. She still wants to be my caregiver during my cancer treatment, but I don't know how to combat my feelings of animosity towards her. Any advice?
Well, yeah, it is a good question. And I think one of the things we really have to do in a scenario like this is aim as high as we possibly can. In this case, that means that you have a caregiver who has some mixed feelings about you and you have reasonable reticence in response. So I would think about your friend pool, even friends of friends, associates, and colleagues, and I would try hard to see if you can expand that group of caregivers, because we often settle for something that's not very respectful. But the problem is that can create bad outcomes down the road. So try to figure out if you can get, honestly, someone else to supplement her.
Excellent. Thank you. And this question is for Dr. Stein. As a gay man, should I get regular screenings for anal cancer and Kaposi sarcoma? I live a healthy lifestyle, but I want to be on top of a potential cancer diagnosis.
I'm not a physician, and so I'm not the best person on cancer screenings, but I would say annual screenings for anal cancer are certainly advisable if one is engaging in anal sex. And I wouldn't want to comment on Kaposi sarcoma. I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, excellent. Dr. Fleischman, do you want to address that as well?
Yeah, I'm not aware of any screening test for Kaposi sarcoma. I don't believe that scans would necessarily find something, because it's not in a particular place that could be looked for, and there probably would be a lot of false positives resulting in unnecessary biopsies. So I'm not sure that screening is really effective for Kaposi sarcoma. As far as anal cancers, yes, screening, again, seeing someone who is really familiar with these issues and knows how to write the paperwork up so that the bill gets paid by your insurance is really important.
Excellent, thank you. A question for Ms. Dickens. As I can't fight the feeling that as a transgender woman, I will not receive the same quality of care that a cisgender person would receive. How can I ensure I am receiving the best care? What questions do I ask, and what behavior should I look out for?
That's a great question. What I would say in terms of that is a legitimate question as well. How could you know you're getting the best care? We hear a lot of times social workers about the best. What you want is somebody you could trust and somebody that you could really believe in the healthcare team. So as I mentioned too, if it's not the oncologist, then reach out to other people such as a nurse practitioner or social worker. And also in terms of what you're raising there, you might be well served rather than a group to try to get into some individual counseling to really look at what issues are coming up historical, and again, validating that those are based on very real interactions that you've experienced throughout your life. But to kind of minimize your response so as not to impede your care.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr.
May I also say something with that one?
Yes.
Is it possible to add another point?
Yes. Absolutely. Thank you.
Great. Okay. So this is Scout. So we really do understand from patient-centered care that it's interesting if two people give you the identical pills, but you have a greater faith, trust, and respect from one doctor versus the other, you'll get healthier with the one you have greater faith, trust, and respect with. So you really do get a lot of signs. I mean, doctors will be trying to do their best care for you, but you're going to get a lot of signs on how they treat you if they actually respect you and want to do their best for you. So just understand that the way they interact with you socially is going to be a signifier of how far they're going to go to make sure you get the very best care. And if they're falling short on that, get a different doctor.
Excellent point. So always, you know, consider a second opinion. Get someone that, and you might check with all the resources we provide you.
Right.
Excellent. Thank you. We have a question from someone about the PAW program, how to access it. All you have to do is call the Cancer Care Hopeline, 1-800-813-4673, or you can go to our website. And we'll be sending you a SurveyMonkey at the end of today's program, well, actually in a couple of days after today's program, probably next week. And in that SurveyMonkey will be all the resources that many of our speakers provided, plus information about how to access the resources of cancer care. So I hope that helps. And let me see if I know where. Oh, this is an important question. So this is a question for Dr. Scout. What do I do if I feel I'm experiencing microaggressions at my treatment center during my course of treatment? Should I switch physicians, or would that be risky for my health?
You're going to see this as a theme in all of my answers here. Yeah, switch physicians. And you can bring it up. You can bring it up to the management. You can bring it up to your physicians. But ultimately, we are going to be healthier if we're with people who we really think treat us with dignity, respect, and without any microaggressions. So we sometimes kind of brush those under the table thinking they're small, we can deal with them, but they're a sign of, again, more of that relationship building is being fractured. And we know from patient-centered care that means you will not be as healthy at the end of the situation. So, yes, invest in trying to get to someone if you're at all able to. If you're not able to get to someone else, then invest in helping support and heal from that with other resources you have, support teams, virtual support groups, things like that. But just make sure that it's not something small. It is actually acknowledged that it's something big that you do not need to be dealing with now. You can't get it out of your life. Try hard to counterbalance it with other joyful, positive things.
Excellent. Thank you. And I'm going to ask our speakers, as we conclude the program, to each provide a takeaway for today's program, starting with Dr. Pratt Chapman, then Dr. Stein, then Dr. Scout, Mr. Dickens, Dr. Fleischman. So do you want to go first, Dr. Pratt Chapman?
Sure. Yeah. So I would say don't underestimate self-advocacy. Advocate for yourself and advocate for others to the extent that you feel safe and able to do so. And if you're in a position of authority in a healthcare system, do what you can where you can to make things as safe and affirming as possible.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Stein?
I would say all of us in the LGBTQI community experience discrimination at some level in receiving health care, and that most of the time we should not be putting up with this. We should rely on community organizations and support groups and advocacy and legal services when necessary to help us deal with very bad or discriminatory behaviors. I think, as Scout said earlier, we need to have providers that we can trust.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you. And Dr. Scout?
Maybe one for the providers. Now is not the time to be silent. Silence is very, very loud. So please let us see that safety before we get to your office. And then for the patients and the queer community members and the allies and our loved ones, now is also not the time to accept second best. Like, the way we're being treated in the legislative environment is the exact opposite of what we deserve. So stand up for it in the healthcare world.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much. And Mr. Dickens.
Well, I would support everything that was said, especially the advocacy issue. As somebody who's spoken to hundreds to thousands of people around the country, I totally agree in terms of getting respect and the best treatment, but also so often I would hear of people who don't have transportation, who don't have the supports, who are in rural areas that they don't have access to a larger cancer community. And in those cases, again, I would go back to the team or people that you could talk to, try to mitigate and understand the feelings that are being coming out in you. And there are national organizations you could participate in, but it's an added stressor, and sometimes it's an impossibility to get to a center that is going to be more compassionate. So how do you make it work for you, and how do you engender the hope within yourself that you are getting the treatment that is going to be the best, provide you with the best outcome? That's so important to those, again, who don't have access to the larger treatment centers or for various reasons, or the best doctors sometimes.
Thank you so much. And Dr. Fleischman.
Sure. I think things are moving in the right direction, but there are still many areas that need improvement as far as equity and care. For any of you who have specific questions about, let's say, biopsies or screening, that's different for the LGBTQ+I+ community. I would probably try to get that question answered at one of the larger cancer centers, usually university-associated academic cancer centers, then the National Cancer Institute Comprehensive Cancer Centers, or the accredited American College of Surgeons Commission on Cancer Centers. These are larger centers that do research as well as patient care and would be able to refer you to the right person in the community or close by if there's no one that they know of right there.
Excellent. Thank you. I want to thank our speakers. You've been phenomenal. And I want to thank our participants also for asking such fantastic questions, actually important questions, actually. And I think the combination of our both wonderful participants and wonderful speakers really made this call as informative as it was, actually. So I want to thank you all for your being part of this. I also want to acknowledge that there are many of you still in queue. We could not take all the questions. I want to say a few words about all of you in queue that are still waiting for an answer to your questions. If you've asked a question, if you have a question that is in queue, we ask you all to take those questions back to your treating healthcare team. They know you the best. They actually know the specifics of your situation. And actually, so ask them the questions again, and ask them the question with a degree of confidence that you've gotten from this call, that your questions are important and need to be addressed. Also, for those of you seeking a second opinion, even if you are in a rural area or you're far away from a place, there are major cancer centers in this country that will actually work with you if you're in a rural area to try to get you the care that you need. They will consult with the doctors treating you if you would like that to happen. There's no extra cost for that. That is their mandate as a comprehensive cancer center to do that. So just to be aware of that as well. In addition, we would not want anyone to leave today's call feeling that you're alone. We want you to know now that you're part of the community of support. And you will be getting a SurveyMonkey evaluation. In that is an evaluation of the program, but also you'll be getting lots of resources provided by Dr. Chapman, Dr. Stein, and Mr. Dickens, and some other resources as well. But you'll be getting quite a few resources that you'll be able to look at and really take advantage of those resources. They're all free resources to contact, and they also may be able to help you with some of the issues that you raised on today's call. So again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.